Sir David Thorne, Reel 15. How long would the daily conference in the morning prayers take normally?
Normally take a half to three quarters of an hour, depending on whether there was a major issue. And generally, person would just go around the room in an order, and normally it was the European area first, and Russia, and then you'd switch to the rest of the world, and first in that would be China, and the violent situation, and then the rest of the world beyond that. And then we would get back to the office, and as I said, the work of the day would proceed. Now, the work of the day could be in any of those fields that I've mentioned, because certainly for quite a lot of time I was there, we were conducting a major study on the development of armour and armoured tactics within the Chinese army, and where it had got to. You know, we talked about interpretation of photographic material, and we were doing a lot of looking at that. This is very much in the interest of the CIA and the DIA, as well as ourselves, because a lot of the material came from them anyway, and so they would want to have access to the production we'd made. And on that we had a specific officer seconded from a cavalry regiment, but frankly I knew far more about armed warfare than a captain, and a captain who was a very good guy, pretty intelligent, but he hadn't got his understanding of where we'd come from in armed warfare. And so I would spend time perhaps there. I would spend time on what was happening in Hong Kong and the latest batch of interrogation reports, from debriefing reports from people who come over the border. And I would go through all the SIGINT for if there were any threads to follow for the previous 24 hours. And then it was correspondence as well with the Americans, with Hong Kong, with agencies in this country and so on. So there was, I never found there was a shortage of work to do.
A busy day.
It was a busy day, and it was also fairly, fairly interesting, because you had to put yourself in the mind of the Chinese all the time. And that taught me a strong lesson, which I used in Northern Ireland when I became brigade commander.
Stepping over the cultural barrier as well.
You have to. And then you begin to be realistic, and you begin to see what drives them, and you begin to know then what their likely next actions are. Otherwise, you're just trying to push them into the sort of package that you think you'd like them to do. That's lethal.
Thinking back to that time, if you can remember, was it the case that the Chinese were simply attempting to follow Soviet armoured warfare doctrine, or were they adapting it and developing a theory of their own?
I think they would like to say that they were adapting it. And certainly they intended to. And they had, although I can't recall what they were now, but I know they had adaptations to the tank, simple adaptations, which they had, the Chinese T-54 had differences from the Russian T-54 in technical differences. As to tactics, we saw no great evidence that they reached a standard of training overall that would allow them to develop the kind of armoured warfare tactics that were going to be highlighted by the reforms in the British Army of the Rhine in the 1980s, after our technique and really picking up the whole business of total warfare, which of course stemmed from Rommel, but in a sense needed freshening up and translating into a proper relationship with the equipment that we had in the 1980s. Little sign of any of that happening in the Chinese army of the 1960s. They were just starting to get themselves onto a proper first run of having a decent armoured force. And They were beginners.
Was the Chinese T-34 an effective and reliable tank?
T-54. We didn't see enough of it out on training to be certain, which is a pretty good indication that probably it wouldn't have been beyond a certain length of time.
Did they conduct large-scale armoured exercises?
A few, and smaller scale, quite a lot. But, in a sense, their force was being expanded then and needed to be considerably, because there was a token force of armour, really, in many ways, as opposed to a mass force of armour. They hadn't reached a stage where they could conduct army-level or corps-level armoured warfare training in the way that we could in the West.
What would be their highest level then? Would they have been able to mount a divisional exercise?
Well, yes, you're talking about divisional exercise, and you're talking about a corps.
Yeah.
But, you know, where's your enemy coming from, and so on and so forth. I mean, so they had the capacity, and they had the inclination, but they had so many other things to do, and there were, you know, the political pressures and so on and so forth, would suggest that it was, you know, these were early days, but there were the first signs that they were trying to get themselves into a new era in terms of their army being able to conduct an army with them. And they knew it was essential.
What about, I mean, amongst the personnel, you mentioned Mao Tse-tung, and we've discussed Lin Piao. At this time, was Chu Tae still effective?
Was
Chu Tae?
Having a blank.
He was the first commander of the Red Army, the chap who was with Mao from the days of the Long March onwards.
Absolutely. And, that would be a John Bailey question.
Yes. So, I mean, he was, I mean, the three of them died in 1976. Chu Tae, Mao, and Chou Enlai, they all died in the same year.
This shows you that his name is not in my mind, but therefore the odds are, and I'd have to refer back to someone like John Bailey, but he was not an influential figure at that stage. And I'd have thought if he had been, it would have been more towards caution by getting involved in, you know, he'd been conservative, but I don't know.
Now, also you mentioned that within your general division, not your specific responsibility, you'd got Cambodia and Vietnam and so on. I mean, presumably there you were dependent to a great degree on the Americans for information, hard information, and false interpretation of what was going on.
Yeah. That's right. Whereas we could provide information to them about troop movements south,
yes,
they could provide information about what was happening in the country.
I mean, was there a prospect at any time of, did you think, of a major Chinese intervention into the war in Vietnam while the Americans were still there? Because you arrived around about the time of Tet, didn't you?
Everyone was looking at that sort of thing and conscious of the importance of it. I think the Chinese made a point of being careful not to send those sort of signals.
I seem to remember they had some anti-aircraft troops around Hanoi at one time.
But no great sort of defensive, yet not offensive.
Oh.
Very careful not to send offensive messages. That seemed to be the friend of the Vietnamese, yes. That's very good politics. And they could defend themselves to world opinion and hands off the Americans on that issue very easily if it was defending Hanoi, defending Vietnam against aggression. Nothing aggressive against the Americans.
Because the other area which was always tense was Korea. Was there much going on in that area in in the northeast, along the Korean border that you knew of at the time?
Now, I don't recall there being much, or I know we were very conscious of it. And that's why the fact that we always knew when the army was out keeping the air cooled.
Yeah.
Because we knew about the treatment and we knew what it was, and we didn't overreact because of that. But no, I'm not conscious that there's much more the Russians up that flank, further up, the Sori River and so on. And that was the big issue.
And you said that you thought that if it came to a full-scale clash along that frontier, the Chinese would have come off worst. I mean, it always looked as though, as a maximum effort, the Chinese might just have been able to get Khabarovsk. Whether they'd have been able to hold on to it would have been another matter. But the Russians always said they were sensitive about the maritime province and the threat to Vladivostok.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think that again is very good politics, because by saying they were sensitive to it, they were warning the Chinese. Secondly, they, in a sense, they were sensitive to it, and therefore they're saying, look, we will react very strongly if you do something about this. And they could react in a number of areas, in a number of ways, and ultimately with some form of nuclear. And of course, we were always watching for the Chinese developing their nuclear capability. Exactly.
Were there any major developments in that area at that time that you remember?
I think just imagine it, but I think there was some form of an underground explosion at that time.
Would that be at Lop Nor in their usual test site, wasn't it?
And I think that again was part of a political signal the Chinese to the Russians, saying, look, we're going to give ourselves a capability to say you cannot dictate to us. That all these jockeys were pushing both countries, like the armed warfare.
Yes.
They were being pushed into this because the Russians were a threat to them. The Russians had enormous armed forces. And they were being pushed into the nuclear bit because the Russians had nuclear weapons. And in the end, the Russians threatened them.
They needed a deterrent of their own.
They needed. Ultimately, it's a conservative country of enormous size and strength, which wanted to be left alone.
Of course, their great vulnerability, as I remember it, was the not having a good delivery system. That their missile technology was rather poor.
The system just wasn't up to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And were they improving it at the time? Do you remember if they were doing any?
They certainly we were looking at. Again, I'm fishing now back into my memory.
Yes.
But.
So liquid fueled, weren't they, still at that stage?
Yeah.
First generation.
Yeah, that's right. They certainly were making occasional flight, which indicated that they were working on this as a priority. Because it was about the same time they started to show an interest. It's very interesting in terms of their foreign policy that, as I recall, it's about that time we began to see them showing a renewed interest in the eastern coast of Africa and the railway lines and
The Tanzanian involvement.
And elsewhere.
Did that fall into your remit as well? Chinese interference in
exterior interests outside the country. And if only to comment upon it. Now, what I didn't know then, which I don't know now, is because they had an interest in the east coast of Africa, and of course in the east coast and the west coast of India.
Yes.
For centuries, the 15th century, 14th century, they were sending their eunuch princes with navies into the Indian Ocean and over to the African coast. So it's an extraordinary world. These interests recur and recur.
What was it that drew their attention to Tanzania and to that area of Africa? Had they got anything specific to attract them?
I think Nyerere's form of communism was probably one which they felt comfortable with. He probably wanted to separate himself from close connections with the West, whilst not ignoring them. And so they were, in a sense, a soft target. And into there, the Chinese could shift their small arms and could create influence in that way. division of islands and so on. They've been doing it ever since, on and off. And the Chinese, I think I might say, have built, yeah, the Belgians have built a weapon factory. The Chinese in Kenya. And there's no ammunition factory there, I think. That is what Chinese, but the Chinese are putting weapons in there, in the whole of the Great Lakes area and around, for numbers and numbers and numbers of years. And their weapons are swimming around in it now.
Is this just trying to gain influence?
Yes.
And
obtain influence. Provide their engineers, provide technical support.
They built the Tanzam Railway, didn't they?
That's right.
Tanzania to Zambia. Was that seen as being primarily a military effort, or was it seen as genuinely civil?
A typical example of the People's Liberation Army working as an extended arm of civil society and the nation as a whole.
Construction force.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, the only really dedicated satellite the Chinese had at that time outside the Far East was Albania.
And yes.
Well, beggars can't be choosers. And, did you have a sort of direct liaison with the man on the European side who was looking
yes.
at Albania?
Yes, yeah. Obviously, the reports from Albania about the Chinese involvement were always of great interest to us. The logic of it all was, other than the strategic, very broad, single aim of having a foothold.
Yeah.
It was very difficult to see where they're going to get with Albania, because in a sense it was almost an enclosed state within a series of enclosed states.
Indeed, an enclave beyond an enclave.
Absolutely. So it was difficult to understand, but once again it was Albania looking for good, wanting to be friends with us, and the Chinese saying, okay. But Tanzania was much shrewder. Nera had much shrewder adventure, and they've never quite let go of that African influence. And I think historically, you know, there's reason to understand it too. It's trading goods, its influence in Africa, its areas where they're seen as preferred partners. And this is going to be much more significant in the next century. So past history will be born into play, maybe. But rather like the Irish or the IRA, history means a lot to the Chinese.
Well, if you have a cyclical view of time rather than a linear view of time, then you expect recurrences, don't you? And you prepare for them. And,
I think so.
Yeah.
You should talk to sinologists about this way in a way more than me, but and I just, you know, I picked up one or two of the basic verities, you know, that China views themselves as the centre of the world, the kingdom. Their view hasn't changed at all, and they're seeing their time as coming in the next century. And I think, you know, we want to link with them as far as we can, as well as being pretty observant on them. But I don't see any aggressive tendencies as yet. Well, I think there's a comeuppance sooner or later is between China and Japan.
Well, there are obviously a number of other regional powers who have already clashed with China. Japan, there's been friction. Political, economic, and diplomatic. Nothing really military to date, but there was the Sino-Indian War
Absolutely.
Of 62. And I was going to ask if you've got any, you had any sort of cooperation with if you had any, and if you had any intelligence coming from India, if you had any relationship with the Indian Defence Forces and their intelligence gathering, because they.
We certainly have. Very good links with the Commonwealth countries.
Yes.
With the Indian High Commission.
Yes. Did you get anything from them? You know, because they I mean, they were rubbing up against Tibet.
I'm sure you did. And I, you know, now you remind me. And by the way, I've sort of been in contact with the Indian military and the High Commission on a number of occasions since, you know, other incarnations.
Yes.
Those links are very good. The Indians are also very careful of their intelligence.
Oh.
Quite bureaucratically careful.
Is this to protect their sources?
Third world power.
Yes.
And so their army would be much more likely to talk to us than their intelligence community. And we would be much more likely to have a very good communion with their army, because we get on extremely well with them, as you know. And we're very comfortable with them. So I think the Indians, again, got a hell of a shock. They found that the Chinese were very hardy up in the mountains, well based in Tibet. The Indians had enormous long lines of sort of logistic support to protect if they were going to protect their frontiers. Mm. And so the Chinese gave them a hard time.
Well, I think the Chinese had built their all-weather road along the frontiers, they had been realistic in working out a portering system to support their frontline troops, and the Indians hadn't. They were relying on motor transport in an area where there were no roads.
I don't think the Indians believed the Chinese would do this.
Oh no, it came as a surprise. The Chinese managed to achieve.
Which again tells you something about. I mean, the Indians. The Chinese are strong. As a people's army, mass infantry, fought each by human beings, best employed in mountains, in deserts, in places like tanks, are not comfortable, whether it may be deserts, that's not the right example, but, and of course this mountain warfare. Okay. It says a lot, actually, for their efficiency, and it shook people when they did this. It shook, I think, the international community as well as the Indian in particular.
Well, I mean, did you also get information about what they were doing on the other side of the thing, about the Xi Chin era?
And their sort of predilection to link rather closely with the Pakistanis, because this was good politics and it isolated the Indians and so on and so forth.
I think perhaps the Indians were caught napping partly because they had been so preoccupied with Pakistan, the obvious enemy, that they really rather neglected their other neighbour.
Yeah, that's right. Often, I can't remember the background of why.
It was border demarcation about Thagla, Bomdila, and various other passes. Mm. And most of them were, well, the significant sites were really monastic communities on the old roads up into the mountains.
My regiment provided the machine gun detachment for Young Hudson's expedition into Tibet in 1904. We got some very good stuff in the language when we were dealing with it.
They knew the ground well then.
They got there. Fascinating part of the world in which, again, the Chinese have decided to take control of Tibet, and they have done.
Did you have good sources coming out of Tibet? Because I think there's a continuous stream of refugees coming out into Nepal. That's their principal way out, isn't it? Through into Kathmandu.
And not as a... I mean, the real stream that brought us a big return was out of Hong Kong.
Yeah.
That's where we got our intelligence money as well. In a big way. And that's where the most sensitive thing for us was British interest was in Hong Kong.
I think after doing this for, was it 2 years you were at, you were then sent off to be a teacher at...
Well, I sent to Blackpool.
Yes. This is another, really another sort of academic cum sedentary
that,
posting,
right,
isn't it?
And it was tied directly to the fact that I'd been, so I was basically a DS.
Yes.
One of the free service staff corps, but it's sort of unusually, I was a DS to the RAF staff corps, but for a very good reason that I'd actually worked for the RAF before. And in many ways, that was very conventional. It was enjoyable. I met a lot of the future leaders of the Air Force and worked with them. And so people like Mike Graydon, one of my students who just finished being chief of the Air Staff. There were a number of others who got to Air Rank. And so the value to me was in meeting them. The staff training and disciplines and the military bit. I held my own quite happily, and says he glibly.
How did it compare to Camberley in its things like its syllabus and methods of instruction? And
Older students.
Older students.
Mm-hmm. More independent minded. Not necessarily so keen on pleasing the DS. Very healthy. Because they run plans. They don't run battalions, regiments. And so the sort of the corporate togetherness of the army, which tends towards, unless you're bloody careful, towards the tendency to agree with your commanding officer or to disagree with them, is a characteristic which in the Air Force, because they fly planes, it's not quite so much the fault. And so you came in for some quite interesting debates and conversations. That said, there was the other side to the IS students, that you had to really work at getting them to play. They were very serious about their profession. But, I had to really coax them to get involved in the sport and in this and that and so on, which is probably more second nature to your corporate togetherness of the regiment, where you expect to do that automatically. And so when you come to Staff Wars, you do it automatically as well. So there's slightly less, the social side is very strong, very good, but it was a bit more forced than would be natural in the army staff college.
Was it more formal?
Yeah, pretty formal at times. I was very conscious of that.
How did they select their people to go to Bracknell? How did that compare to the army's method?
Well, I think it's very similar.
It was a similar method.
An exam, and then an assessment of your qualities as a leader. And your recent reports all put together. And they're picking them up. I don't know whether they have a system we have, which is the top 10% of the credit. I don't think they have that.
But what about the method? Did you have the sort of 10-man syndicate system as we had at Camberley?
Very similar to Camberley. Very similar program, but with the Air Force connotations and Air Force problems. So I learned a lot about that. And that was good for my brain.
Did you become au courant with theories of air warfare in the same way in which you become current with theories of armoured warfare earlier on?
Yes. I had to read out those sort of things and some of them sort of was lost on me fairly quickly afterwards, because it was common sense. Really. Well, like most of strategy is common sense. So, went all through that. And also, also the disciplines like moving a lot of people from A to B by air, the liaison work with the Navy and the Army, issues of discipline and leadership.
Some people would say that the Air Force, really, given its nature, doesn't practice leadership in the same way as the Army does, that it has administration and management, because the fighting men are a tiny minority, and they're having to operate as individuals or in very small groups, in the, all, each in his own aircraft.
I think that's a real problem that the Air Force have, and they are very aware of it, is that